the regulator's viewpoint is, that's what it's called on the program. So oh, this is Amsterdam, that's also where my country, but...
Do you think we can get Peter de Graaf's presentation? Or, of course, it would be interesting to have him give Fleck Verhoek's lecture, but...
We have to be flexible. We have to be adaptive.
This is an adaptive morning. So while they try to find the slides, let me ask Johan Sylvain, do we have any questions from Ukraine, Russia, or Beijing at this time? No, okay. So that didn't save me. So you also had a specific question, I know, comment to this, so...
Yes, well, in my short presentation, I was already referring to our position and our viewpoint on this adaptive design. And I had summarized a little bit what our current opinions on this was, and I also referred to the FDA. As you remember, last year there was a publication in the New England Journal of Medicine where the FDA explained why they, with dabigatran, based on the data of the RELY study, they chose for the 150 milligram dose. And because there were two dosages, as you know, 110 and 150, and they had a lengthy discussion, and in the end, they decided only to go for one dose. And in that article, they reasoned why they did that. And that was not because it was adaptive, but because they thought, well, if we look at all the data and we do our own analysis and we make our own benefit risk and we look at standard groups and high risk groups, then in the end we end up even in high risk groups for the 150 milligrams dose. And that is because if you look at the criteria, you have on the one hand, of course, efficacy, you have the antithrombotic endpoints, and on the other hand, you have the bleeding. And I think that's one of the issues also if you go for adaptive licensing, what is going to be your criterion? Because in the end, it's a balance. So in the end, what is your endpoint going to be basis, and what the basis is for your adaptation? And whether we should go for bleeding or for antithrombotic effect or in the end for a net effect. And in the end, they put more emphasis on the and on the effect and not on the bleeding, because they focused, they thought the prevention of stroke was more important than a somewhat increased risk of bleeding, which I think is pretty provocative. In Europe, and that's where you see it's subjective how you interpret the data, and I think that's one of the problems of adaptive licensing. We put more emphasis on the bleeding risk, and we still go for the low dose, the 110 milligrams, for the high-risk bleeding groups. And that's also worded in the SPC. So I think we have a different opinion here. But in the end, the FDA said, okay, go for phase three, go for more dosages, but not, I think, adaptive, but more arms. And in the end, make a summary. And it's not really a matter of p-values then, but it's more a matter of sound thinking. And that in itself, I think, might be a pretty good approach, because if you look at the guidelines we are rewriting at the moment with regards to atrial fibrillation prevention of stroke and also for high-risk surgery, we are still very conservative. We say, okay, go for the phase two. We call that in regulatory world, we call that therapeutic exploratory studies. That's where the dose finding is, and then in phase three, the main thing is to look at the high-risk patients. I mean, that's more or less retrospective. So adaptive licensing at this moment is not really in our thinking, and it's also not anywhere mentioned in the draft guideline, which is currently on the net and where you can still comment if you want, on how we should do that. In the meantime, we got a comment from the FDA on the guidelines we are writing, and that comment indeed included that they want to be more flexible, and they want to put more emphasis on different arms and sound thinking. May I have? My presentation is here. Let me see. But I just can. I think I'm already coming to my last slide. I have to.
But it was pretty clear talking, so people you could appreciate the silence here are important. This is quite important information you give us.
But this is what regulation, of course, is about. I mean, that's making the benefit-risk assessment, and that's the weighing. And as I said, it's pretty subjective, because even with dabigatran, I think we have chosen a different dose than the FDA. So this is the dose we have been choosing. And this is what's currently in the guideline. I think it's pretty conservative. You can read it on the net. They are out for consultation. We have to think more about it next year. So I'm very happy to be here because I think I can learn a lot because I'm chairing the working party which makes these guidelines. And I think they're pretty important also for the clinicians who do these trials because the company, as you already have heard, puts a lot of importance to them because in the end it determines whether or not the drug is going to be accepted. So I think the discussion points, I don't have the answers, to be honest. I think we have to get more from the phase 3 trials, from the therapeutic confirmatory trials. I think that's clear. Whether the adaptive design is the solution, I'm not sure. I think we might go for, we would prefer more fixed doses, but then with flexible designs to go lower in case of high-risk patients and see where we end. I think that's what I first thought would like to say. Question also is what kind of controls are we going to use? Are we going to continue using the oral anticoagulants, or are we going more for a comparison with the existing drugs? I think that's also important. And finally, I think it's important, and I think we should discuss that today, what is the endpoint which we are going to use to adapt the doses? Is it indeed the antithrombotic effect? Is it the bleeding effect? Or is it both? Is it the net benefit? And of course, the antithrombotic effect shows up only after 6 months, 12 months. So that makes adaptive licensing, I think, pretty complicated. We now, in our guidelines, have been pretty discouraging about this net benefit as a primary endpoint. FDA has already criticized us for that, and I think we might be a little bit more flexible on that than we are doing now for the moment. So I'm also adapting, I think, having got the comments and having, seeing this discussion, I think we have to change our recommendations. But how, I think, well, we will discuss that further. So thank you very much. That's what I would like to say.
So any rebuttals from trialists or industry to this information?
In general, we never like interim analysis, but that's also a little bit fixed point of view. But
yeah, what do you like?
If we would like to kill a drug, then we say, okay, it's an interim analysis. No good. So yeah, but I think that's not the way to go, I think.
Our experience with the FDA is quite similar to what was described here in Europe. And I would personally like to see net benefit as an endpoint. So right now the FDA, we present it to them, we give them that data, we put it in our label, but they really don't really respond in a positive fashion to the net clinical benefit. And also I think, I have to agree that I don't think from an industry and regulatory perspective, we're ready for adaptive design in cardiovascular medicine.
That's a little bit too narrow. The warfarin trial just came to mind where you're checking on assumptions and you're not, if you had the variance all wrong, you had the sample size all wrong, and taking that interim look, one interim look, to see if the trial should be increased in size, that just doesn't affect alpha. I'm sure the FDA would find it acceptable.
Somebody needs to lobby the FDA about this because I know this is not my opinion, this is just my experience.
We at NIH don't lobby. It's not one of the things we do.
I understand. I'm not necessarily saying you, but I think in general, if we want to move forward with this type of design, then I think the regulators have to buy in. Otherwise, we're just spinning our wheels.
Well, I thought since the FDA had guidance on adaptive designs, and there are several people at the FDA who are statisticians who work in the area, who have published in the area, I thought that the FDA would have a fairly positive view. I guess you have to be really careful about following the rules. And maybe that's what the issue is. If you come up with some new adaptive design and nobody knows its properties, the FDA is not going to let you do it, or any regulatory agency, I suspect. I had something to say about Peter's comments, which I enjoyed very much, which is that there's, for me, an elephant in the room about the comparator. The dabigatran trial, RELY, did not blind warfarin. So the two doses of dabigatran were blinded, but warfarin was not blinded. And we have no idea how not partially blinding a trial rather than fully blinding it affects outcome. So if you were on warfarin in any of the dabigatran trials, you knew you were on warfarin, and you knew your dose of aspirin, it wasn't blinded in Petro. We can't say the effect of that. So when you consider, and you know, people think blinding warfarin is hard, but actually we do it in COAG. We blind warfarin dose by using dummy pills. So it's hard and it's a little more trouble. But I would argue that it makes results less controversial.
So let's move to the right side and then come back to Michael Gibson. Please, we have a...
Thank you. Yep. So Scott Berkowitz from Baird, just another industry view in terms of practicality. I think the issue of adaptive design for us in thrombotic trials, at least, is still cutting edge and novel. And the problems we face in the industry are that we don't get many bites at the apple here. We only get a couple of shots. And my experience has been that a very good phase two programs, as Dr. Gibson mentioned, we did for ACS, we did for orthopedics or VTE, we didn't do AF as dabigatran did. This information is very important to us going forward. And when we add the extra dose, if we try to do a three-arm in phase three, dropping an arm is not very common. Usually what happens is we have difficulty getting separated, strongly separated doses. And so you end up having things that are very close and you get far out and you still can't see a difference. Moreover, the practicality is it's difficult to bring that data in when you're doing global trials in real time. And you can say, well, that's our responsibility, but it's just not as easy to get it in for this DSMB until you have most of the patients in already. So this creates another problem for us. So I think the focus for us right now is to make sure that we don't lose information. When we drop arms, we lose information on doses as well. And what we would rather do is spend that time going out 6 months or more and really capturing important safety information in the doses we do study.
Okay, Frank Verheugt.
Yeah, Nancy, I disagree with you. We have quite some experience in doing warfarin blinded studies. For instance, in the Netherlands, and I hope Peter and Martin will support me here, we did already a double-blind study with warfarin after myocardial infarction in the 70s, when the first large computers were there. We published in 1980 a double-blind study, the 60-plus reinfarction trial, where placebo was compared to warfarin in a double-blind way. So I think, especially for atrial fibrillation nowadays, if you do a warfarin-controlled study, it should be double-blind. To give an example, do you remember the Sportive 3 and 5 trials? Those were done with cimelagatran. The Sportive 3 trial was run in Europe, and in the rest of, but not in the U.S., was open-label, and Sportive 5 was run in the U.S., was double-blind. And the dosing of cimelagatran in both trials was exactly the same. The outcome of the studies was quite different. In the open-label study, cimelagatran proved to be better, where in the double-blind study, it was the other way around. Warfarin looked better. It was not statistically significant, but nearly won over the same dose of cimelagatran in the open-label Sportive 3 trial. And these were large trials. There were nearly 4,000 patients in each study. So I think the blinding of warfarin can influence the results of these stroke prevention trials heavily.
Certainly, you didn't disagree with me. You agreed with me. but I need to say that
Nancy, you sound like my wife.
Well, I guess I should say thank you. I need to say that in the workshop that follows this, I'm giving a talk on blinding. So, if for those of you who are staying, there's more to come on this subject.
Okay, thank you. Michael Gibson, you, apart from the family issues, you also had...
I just wanted to say that I felt right at home. But if we are moving to an adaptive design, one of the things to keep in mind pragmatically is the submission of events and the adjudication of events. What often happens in trials is these events kind of pile up and then people get together and adjudicate events somewhere near the end of the study. We can't have that happen in adaptive design or really currently. We've moved more towards real-time, continuous adjudication of these events so that CECs and DSMBs actually can make better decisions. I don't think we should really impugn all regulatory agencies and their inflexibility. And the FDA actually is fayly flexible with respect to Bayesian design on the device side, and I am doing some device studies where adaptive design and Bayesian analyses are being used. And finally, in addition to the open label issue in a trial like RELY, one of the things I was very confused by and remain very confused by is not just the regulatory decision, but also the New England Journal decision to publish the safety data as ITT rather than as treated. And, you know, when you do ITT, you're kind of blending in a lot of people who stopped drug or never took drug, and it really dilutes out the safety signal. So really an on-treatment analysis, I think we should really get back to that for safety.
Thanks for those comments. Angeles, Alonso, and then, yes, Basil Lewis, afterwards.
Yes, first of all, I apologize for being late. And just introduce myself. I am a cardiologist, and I work in AMEA with Peter De Graaf and the Scientific Advice Working Party. And just focusing on what we say, we are talking here. In the Scientific Advice Working Party, we got a lot of scientific advices with one or two questions about those findings when in their development program. And our simple answer for the late year is that's just the risk of the company and finish. We don't care about the exploratory trials. It's up to you to do a correct phase two study, exploratory study, and they come to the phase three, the dose that you think that is the best one regarding the net clinical benefit. And that has been our answer for the latest years. Now things are changing, and although Peter is right that the new guidelines are just focusing in these type of drugs, these antithrombotic drugs, we still stick close to do a correct exploratory trials. The problem is that the company come to us with the development program saying, we did it correct, and I perfect those two finding trials, and we don't know. There's two doses that they are very close in the net clinical benefit. So what do we do now? Can we test two doses in a phase two trial in order to know which will be the best one? And in that sense, I think that the AMEA is moving forward in the same sense that the FDA. We have an adaptive clinical guidelines, and they say that you can do it. You can do it in a perfect way if you just pre-specify how you do it. You do test two doses in the first trial. You pre-specify that you're going to do an interim analysis. You will stop one dose, and you will move forward with the correct dose for the phase three. So I think that in this sense, and they are doing that in some new antithrombotic drugs.
Thanks. But let me ask Basil first.
I think that we've learned some stuff. Everyone in this room knows how clinical trials are done practically. And if we're talking about adaptive design and decision-making while you're doing the study, I think we have to have some safeguards about seeing who are the patients we have in the trials. And we've had some experiences when we did, APPRAISE? I think Frick Verheugt will remember it very well, that the trial was, everything we say is correct, but when the trial went out, the first 1,000 patients came from a certain population group. The curves that we're looking at to make our decisions were not reflecting what the data that we thought they were reflecting. The first 6 months were reflecting this particular medical practice, the next 6 months. So we need some safeguards. Perhaps we need to think again of how you recruit patients, how you include people in trials, to make sure that the sample you're going to make such important decisions on is clearly representative of the decisions you want, the population that you want to make the decisions on. And a second thing, I've got a comment about the net clinical benefit. Net clinical benefit is clearly the most important thing that you have in everybody's mind when you have a patient in front of you. Am I prepared to take the chance of a bleed to prevent a stroke? And I think that net clinical benefit works great in the individual patient. But I think as a whole trial, it's very problematic. I mean, would I prefer a nosebleed to a stroke? Well, probably I would. But I wouldn't expect to die of a bleed instead of a stroke. And I think these things have to be very carefully thought out.
Thanks.
With respect to net clinical benefit, we've done a lot of thinking about this. And one of the problems is, as we just heard, you don't want to equate a nosebleed with a stroke. So we have followed some of the regulatory guidance, which is to look at fatal or irreversible bleeding events and put those on a par with fatal or irreversible ischemic events. And that all sounds really good, but the problem is, at the end of the day, those patients who have the highest risk of bleeding events are also those who have the highest potential benefit in terms of ischemia. And what can happen, perversely and paradoxically, is the best net clinical benefit can be seen in the low-risk patients who have very low risk of bleeding, but they didn't have a lot to gain in terms of efficacy. So it can lead you to some clinical conclusions that probably are not well-founded.
Dr. Verheug?
Yeah, another point I think I would like to raise here is the timing of bleeding and the timing of benefit from a certain antithrombotic strategy. We know from our old, very old warfarin trials following myocardial infarction that bleeding comes first and the benefit comes late. Whereas with antiplatelet drugs, for instance, the benefit in ACS, the benefit comes early and the bleeding comes later. And therefore, I think in the anticoagulant studies, we have to take this into account. It's like the wording of the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche. You can only enjoy if you have suffered before. Agree? And the same is true with the anticoagulant studies. The bleeding comes early. So, like Peter says, I'm not really fond of interim analyses. If you look very early in anticoagulant studies, you will see a lot of bleeding, and maybe the benefit comes later. So, if you do an adaptive design, you should not adapt your doses too early to turn them a little bit down or a little bit up, especially the bleeding issue with anticoagulation, whether it's warfarin or the new anticoagulants. You should be a little bit more patient before you change your strategy or your dose or even stop a study.
But to add to that, the net clinical benefit changes over time. So you have a KM curve of bleeding. You have a KM curve of efficacy. If you subtract those two KM curves, you get net clinical benefit over time. And what you find is exactly what Freck said, which is an early hazard and a late benefit. And you see an acceleration of net clinical benefit late. So we need to not take a static view of net clinical benefit. Net clinical benefit changes over time. If you pass your bleeding stress test, you very well may have some late benefit.
Great comments. Let me ask the entire panel, because Freck Verheug actually asked a very important question. You know, should the standard for these comparative trials be blinded warfarin? There was some nodded their head and some did. Who would accept a trial on a future compound or comparison between compounds that actually have open label warfarin? Would that be acceptable to anyone in the panel? Nobody?
No.
Okay. So clear answer to that one.
I mean, it's acceptable.
Wait a minute. Do we believe it?
I didn't see you. Okay. Go ahead. My left corner.
I prefer blinded trials. Don't misunderstand what I'm about to say. Dabigatran was not a double-blinded trial. RELY was not a double-blinded trial. We accept the results. So I think while maybe everybody sitting on this panel is a purist, and that's great with me, but I think the world accepts the Bigotran results, and the FDA accepted them, and it wasn't a fully blinded trial. So I think we do accept unblinded trials, but we may not like them.
This is like Yogi Berra's statement. In theory, there are no differences between theory and practice, but in practice, there are. So I don't think adaptive studies, if I understand well, they are not very suitable for antithrombotic drugs.
Please. Yeah, from the industry perspective, at least my perspective, the FDA and the EMEA accepted the DVT and the PE program, which was open label. Both trials were open label with respect to warfarin. Our ROCKET trial was double-blinded with respect to warfarin, but I have to tell the audience that when you double-blind a warfarin, you really have to do a blinded INR, which is extraordinarily complicated. Investigators hate it.
It's not. It is not.
And, well...
30 years ago, we
did it with rivaroxaban. We had sham INRs for the placebo patients, and it adds a lot of expense because you have to continually change the placebo and the warfarin doses in both groups. And so it adds expense and difficulty to the trials.
And not at all. No. It's feasible.
Of course,
and
it's feasible.
Have you ever been on a clinical event committee in a warfarin, an open warfarin study? In the narratives of events, the people who do the erasing of the on the data, because you have to be very careful to if you see the word INR, scratch it immediately because the clinical event committee will be unblinded. But it is very difficult. If you have narratives like this of, for instance, a bleeding or a stroke event, if the person who erases the word INR or things like, which could even give a blink of that the patient was on warfarin, sometimes they forget it, and then the clinical event committee is unblinded to adjudicate the thing. So
yeah, well, that's the advantage of... But you need a sham INR when you do...
Absolutely.
I agree with you. Yeah. I don't...
Okay.
Let me just say I like to see double-blinded trials against warfarin, but it adds complexity and cost to the trial. That's
but
the only point
it can be done.
I want to make. It is no question it can be done. We did it with enoxaparin in the past.
Don't have INRs. Agree? With enoxaparin.
Yeah, but when we even double-blinded enoxaparin and heparin, which is challenging also.
That's a challenge, too. So. Yes.
I think one word of caution. When you do blind Coumadin, if you give patients pills that are blinded, but they're the same color as real Coumadin, they can get really mixed up. And you say double the dose, and they're like, do I double the pink one or the blue one? Or it can actually be very problematic, actually. So don't make your pills in blinded study the same color as clinical. No, the blinded ones. Now, if you have an open label study, yes. But
trust me, they will confuse them.
But we're not giving we're not having the patients make decisions over which pills to take in the warfarin trial. They're given the pills to take. So they take all their pills.
No, they're given a variety of pills, and
that's not how we're doing it.
Well, the way it's often done.
But that's
is
not
there,
right. Because well, your point is well taken.
Thank you. You agree with me.
You have to decide who.
I'm just saying that you can blind warfarin the way we. I have a slide, but it's not in my talks in this here. We give everybody five pills. And, you know, some are placebo and some are 1 milligram and some are two. We have, I think, 1, 2, 5 milligram pills. And everybody gets five. They match and they take five pills. They're given their warfarin dose.
Okay. I think that let's end the discussion here. You know, it has been done in the past, and I think it seems like the majority of the panel, if I look at the heads, do not accept as an excuse that it adds to the complexity and the price of a trial to do it right.
May I
answer first, and then Peter de Graaf.
So only one remark. Shall we also consider the INR control? Does the open label design have some aspects that could enhance the INR control and the time on TTR? So.
That's always the, also the point I would like to make. Our discussion is much more always about the time to the time that you are in a therapeutic range than whether it's blinded or not. I mean, the discussion about the TTR is always much more major than the discussion about whether it's blinded or not. I mean, it's always mentioned somewhere, but it's never a major part of the discussion. So.
So now the chairman gets worried if we go into a discussion about the timing in therapeutic range in these trials. I think that's a whole different discussion. I want to ask very briefly just one question that was raised before about the role of the DSMB to the panel, and then I think we'll move on with the different doses and different indication and the presentations by Freek Verheugt and Martin Simons. Afterwards, and then continue the discussion. So my question to the panel, are there any comments about the role of the DSMB? Should the DSMB have a broader defined role rather than just look at patient safety in the future? So maybe, you know, given the power also to extend the period of a trial and issues like that, do you have any comments? I know this is very broadly spoken.
I can make a sponsor comment, Jack Lawrence from Bristol-Myers Squibb. I think on the blinded warfarin topic, we charged our DMC with also looking at the quality of INR control. And throughout the trial, the message back to the team was, do a better job. So we actually found that to be quite helpful. We took that to heart and made it a priority to get the word out to sites to do the best they could to manage warfarin.
Thanks.
Could I say
Martin, and then Michael Gibson afterwards?
Yeah, if you really want to use a DSMB properly, you should not just ask about safety. In this setting, you cannot distinguish or you cannot separate completely safety from the efficacy. So it must always be a look both at the efficacy endpoints and the safety endpoints. You cannot accept basically any bleeding if there is not a efficacy signal in some direction. So you need to look at the balance. In the DSMBs that I've been on, overall the task is somewhat more general, and any comments on the conduct of the trial are welcome. And particularly, we often urge, and that was what Michael also already mentioned, urge to have the adjudication process up speed to really be able to look at the adjudicated data and not just at the investigator reported data. So it is a more general brief, yes.
Okay, thanks. Michael and then Scott.
I think the TTR data is a little bit of a mystery wrapped with an enigma that's a riddle. Because usually when you're not in TTR, you are undertreated. So the perverse thing that happens is when you drive the cohort more and more into therapeutic range with Coumadin, you're actually making them a little more anticoagulated. So, you know, it almost is a little easier target to show less bleeding with better TTR. And that is a concept that I think has largely been lost on people. I think people have been very critical of the people being out of range. Well, that means they're generally undertreated. These drugs are even safer than undertreatment with warfarin. That is the lesson that has been lost on everyone.
Scott and then Freek Verheugt.
Yeah, just to respond to your question, Dr. Clemenson, I worry a bit, unless we have it really well worked out, having the DSMB also weighing heavily in on the efficacy, it changes the experiment. I mean, the safety part, of course, that's why we have this DSMB, and of course, if we have futility and worries about a significant difference, but making changes in a trial that we've set up, especially pivotal trials by the DSMB on efficacy, worries me.
Freek, and then Yarso, and then I'll come.
There are DSMBs where the efficacy is only given at about halfway the trial, at 50% events, for instance, because if you know already early efficacy data, they're always biased by accepting more bleeding. And so I think since you're a safety board, S means safety, you should be informed immediately about safety. And efficacy will come later, but of course, and I agree with Martin, if you see a huge safety issue, then you may look at efficacy data a little bit earlier. But if you don't see a real serious safety signal, then it should be good not to see efficacy data. Because I think you're there for DSMB for safety in the trial, not outside the trial, in the trial. If you see a safety signal in another study, which compares also a certain strategy in a different group of patients, then you should not look at that in the first place. You should only look at the safety of the patients in your trial. Second point, I would like to make the TTR. TTR is kind of holy grail nowadays in warfarin-treated patients. But there are several ways to calculate the TTR. There is the Rosendahl method, which is the most accepted one, but there are also other ones. So it's not a holy grail like mortality or cerebral hemorrhage. And third, there is not a strong relation between TTR and intracranial hemorrhage. I have to warn you for that. Because in the RELY analysis by Lars Valentin, you can see that the incidence of ICH is independent of the time in therapeutic range. And it has something to do with the tissue factor in the brain, but we can discuss that maybe later. So TTR is important for efficacy, I think. There's a straight relationship, as shown by Elaine Hilek. But if you look at ICH alone, there is poor correlation with TTR. It's a problem of warfarin specifically.